Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell. And this week, we are celebrating, as we are all this month, the 10th anniversary of TWIL. Yay! Evan Brown is with us, along with Mike Keyes. We're going to talk about tiny, tiny checks from AT&T, unprecedented elections leading to unprecedented real estate advertising, 10 years of the music industry, and much, much more on this episode of This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 363, recorded October 14th, 2016. Got served on Mars. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. Looking to set up payments for your business? Braintree gives your app or website a payment solution that accepts just about every payment method with one simple integration. Plus, Braintree will give you the first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. To learn more, visit BraintreePayments.com/TWIL. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm very, very excited. We are in the month of our 10th anniversary here at TWIL as a show. And in honor of that, Evan Brown, longtime co-host with me here on This Week in Law, has taken time out of his busy schedule, where he is a partner at Much Shellist in Chicago, to join us today. Hello, Evan. Welcome back.
Hi, Denise, and it's great to be back, and congratulations on 10 years. That's amazing. So really, you know, fun to be here. Looking forward to catching up.
Yeah, it's great. Great to see you. Also here is my co-host, Mike Keyes, partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be with you as always, and wonderful to have Evan with us today as well. Looking forward to learning a lot from him.
Same here, Mike.
I know. It's just great to have you back, Evan. What did I want to say? Oh, I wanted to just mention that my other co-host, Emery, couldn't join us here today. He's a bit busy this week. He'll be back next week. For all you many, many multitudes of Emery fans out there, never fear. He'll be back shortly. But in the meantime, we are going to soldier on without him. And I think the first stories that we're going to talk about today have to do with Hollywood music and entertainment. So I think it's going to be fun throughout the show today if we can kind of look at not only what's happening currently, but sort of get a little bit retrospective and look back on our experiences in technology law over the last 10 years or so, since we've all been slogging away at it for at least that long. And one of the things that I think has been really interesting to watch develop the whole time we've been doing the show, and of course, even before that, is the music industry and the intersection between the music industry and the technology industries. For folks not old enough to have direct experience with and directly remember Napster and then Grokster, which came afterward, those all sort of took place quite a while before we started recording the show in 2006. But just the year before we started doing the show, the Grokster decision from the United States Supreme Court came down. And so I sort of think of that as the beginning of the modern music era, where, you know, Napster went down and so did all of its various clones. And the music industry, though, had to adapt to the fact that people were going to download music unless they offered viable commercial alternatives. And so we've seen that unfolding for at least the last 10 years. And just this week, we see the latest iteration of that process with Amazon Music debuting its Music Unlimited service, which discounts for members of Prime and deeply discounts for owners of its Echo devices. So I wanted to toss all that out to you guys. Evan, any thoughts on the evolution of the relationship between the technology and music industries, Amazon Music specifically, or anything else sort of in this vein?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always interesting to reflect back and see how things go. And, you know, I mean, I watch the industry somewhat. I don't consider myself, you know, a close, you know, inveterate watcher of what's going on with the music industry, but I track how technology develops and how copyright law evolves out of the pressures that new modes of distribution, you know, the way that can strain copyright law. And I think you're quite accurate to see 2005, the Grokster decision being a real watershed moment, or, you know, certainly an important point in time in tracing the history of the online distribution of music. So it's always interesting to reflect back anecdotally just in my own life in the way that I consumed content and consumed music. It was in late 2004. I think we were a little bit late to the game as far as, you know, our friends go, or, you know, people in our community getting a broadband connection in our home. So that was a real change there, which, mm-hmm. You know, made it actually plausible, you know, actually possible, feasible, I guess, reasonably feasible to get that much data into your home. Before that, with a 56K dial-up connection, it would take, you know, 3 hours to download one song or whatever, depending on how that goes. So that was a real interesting, you know, going back 10, 11 years. That was a real interesting time, both in the industry and the landscape, and also for me personally, the way I consume content. It's when I started getting into podcasting. Well, I guess, you know, they say podcasting, you know, started in late 2004. So I started doing a legal podcast early on, and just the whole idea of there being this entirely different mode of getting digital content, it's sort of seeing it as the next step in the succession of at least what I could see in my lifetime. Being born in the mid-70s, being born into a world of vinyl and 8-track, seeing the evolution into the 4-track cassette, then into the CD, and then to the MP3 player, and then sort of the natural way that it goes, you know, with the introduction of the MP3 player and the iPod, of course, mm-hmm. just seeing how that all develops. So it's fun to see how it's gone in this next 10 year, or in this past 10 years, and where we are. And I don't know that where we are now is in that revolutionary of a place that we should have expected to be, given the way things were changing so quickly in the middle part of the last decade. It's like, okay, there's a new Amazon service, looks a lot like Spotify, which has been around for several years, the big, you know, a good fraction of the last 10 years. You know, the Echo deeper discount thing is intriguing as well. But I don't know about you, but I don't know if we've seen a whole lot of wonderful innovation that's really changed things all that much. New pressures to give rise to challenges that the law needs to face in the last 10 years. I don't know. So my reflection and just sort of you know, brief commentary on where we are today. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm right with you. I think the one sort of unique but not terribly revolutionary thing about Amazon's strategy is to give a lower cost option that's bundled with a device. I don't, maybe other people have done that. I'm not thinking of any off the top of my head, but they sort of cover all the bases. For someone who doesn't have an Echo, you can, or Prime, you can pay full freight at a competitive rate with Spotify or Apple Music. But if you have Prime, you get a little bit better deal. So that, you know, pulls you into the Amazon universe there. And if you have an Echo, you get the best deal of all, except for you have to pay per individual Echo. So it's a little bit at odds with their, they seem to have a strategy with their Echo Dots that you would have one of those in every room. But if you're having to pay for a music service on every single one of them, at some point, your expense becomes prohibitive. So I don't know if they've fully thought that one through. But I do think it's an interesting strategy. I thought it was, you're dead on that. One of the things that we've talked about over the last decade on this show is not just the partnership between the technology industry and the music industry and getting legal access to music in a way people will pay for that will solve the music industry's infringement problem. But also changes to the laws as to use of music in general. I would have thought by now, and maybe this is where you were going, Evan, that we would have seen more licensing innovation in the law. Of course, there are still blanket licenses that apply the ASCAP BMI kind of structure that already exists. But I would have thought we'd see more mandatory licensing by now that we haven't seen. And I know that people, there are still people out there lobbying for those kinds of strategies. But the music industry seems to think that things are fine for it as things are. And I think maybe consumers are beginning to feel that way too, since they have so many, you know, if they're not exactly low cost options, they're at least affordable options, better than getting sued options for access to vast libraries of music. Mike, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, it's super fascinating to see where we've come just in the last 10, 12 years, and frankly, where we're going to be in the next 10 or 12 years. Our conversation reminds me of a recent conversation my son and I had. We were listening to NPR, and I think it was like the 35th anniversary of the Sony Walkman. And my son's a freshman in high school, and he'd never heard of what the Walkman was. And, and so we were listening to the story, and I explained for him how it worked. And he said, "Boy, that's just weird." I'm like, "Well, no, it's not weird. That's just how the technology was, 35 years ago." And to think where we've come in 35 years and where we'll be in 35 years from now is really fascinating. I agree with you, Denise, on the issue about compulsory licenses or mandatory licenses. You know, there's I'm not sure. I am generally speaking, a fan of compulsory licenses when it comes to musical works in particular. There's so many different interests in play, though. I think it's going to be probably a while before we see much of a change when it comes to that.
Mm-hmm. There was quite a lot going on about things like Spotify and Pandora will kill the music industry because artists are making so little for each play of the track. Those arguments, I'm sure, still get made, but seem to have gotten a little less loud. It seems to me that, just anecdotally from my observing from the outside, that artists in the music industry are figuring out how to make money from the various outlets that are available to them, even if they'd like to be making more money. Do you guys have that take as well, Evan?
I don't know. I mean, because these are all economic questions. When it comes to the way copyright law ought to affect it, there's nothing inherent in copyright law as an idea, whether we're talking about the current copyright statute or, the particular revisions that ought to be made to address problems in the modern digital economy. There's nothing in there. If people are upset with how little artists are getting paid, they shouldn't look as copyright law in the abstract as the real problem. What the real problem is the way that law and economics work together to create structures where rights and obligations and the ability to license out rights and distribute money based on how those rights are allocated, making sure that there's the proper balance struck there. So, I've often racked my brain trying to come up with solutions to these problems, and I realize it's just above my pay grade. I studied philosophy, not economics, and I can't do arithmetic to save my life. So I'll leave it up to somebody much more intelligent when it comes to those economic questions to solve that sort of the social problem of artists getting compensated and let copyright play its role in just sort of framing the outer traces of the way the system is set up.
Right. Yeah, and going right to that, to the economics of it and finding ways to make the economics of it work for you. I don't know if you've caught our episodes, in the last 6 months or so, Evan, talking about different kinds of music labels that are targeting different kinds of audiences. Two that come to mind are No Copyright Sounds and Monster Cat, that sort of aggregate a bunch of artists and grant a license. They're specifically aimed at sort of the gamer slash YouTube slash Twitch industry, people who want to have soundtracks for the things that they post on those platforms and want to have ready access to music they're not going to get sued for. So the licenses that are in place on those labels are aimed at that. And Emery's done a deep dive. I think it was the No Copyright Sounds one he looked at more closely and thought that, you know, the license was more restrictive than the title suggests, No Copyright Sounds. But yet, I mean, it's still an interesting take on how you get your music out there and listened to, et cetera. And I think they kind of are having it both ways. At least Monster Cat is. I know I listen to that on Apple Music and on Amazon service as well. So they're getting pay for play from those services as well as whoever's, you know, using their music and getting more visibility for their artists by posting tracks to their videos on those platforms. Mike, any other thoughts about this?
Yeah, there's some commentary in chat about how when it comes to digital rights and streaming of music, the end consumer doesn't own the actual copy of the work. It's really set by the terms of use by Apple or whoever the distributor is. And that's correct. I'm not sure that it necessarily undercuts that there's been some fairly significant innovation in the distribution of music. You know, in the old days, when you had a cassette or you had a CD, it's true, you actually owned a physical copy of the work. Now, you were still constrained under copyright as to what you could do with your copy of the work. But yes, in fact, you owned a copy of the work. Now, you know, as we've talked about on the show before, you know, when you download a bunch of music to your iPhone or other digital device, you are constrained under the terms of service by being able to transfer those copies to somebody else. So, yes, there's there's been some significant innovation in terms of how music is delivered, but that you know, those copies are kind of tied up in a way that they weren't tied up in days of yore with CDs and cassette tapes. That is true.
Right. They're tied up both technologically, because I think it's harder to get at. You can do it, I think. You know, I've never tried to do it myself, but I think there are means, ways and means out there available that if you want to rip music out of a stream, you can. But it's more complicated and convoluted than most people would want to go through, I would imagine. And it's also, of course, bound up by the actual terms that govern your use of your streaming service. So you've got a couple of barriers there that aren't in place. You know, I'm sitting here using not the same computer that I think I started using when we recorded the show 10 years ago. In fact, I'm sure it's not the same, but it's, you know, its hard drive has come along with me since that original computer. And it's got music on it that I ripped from CDs way back in the day when that was how you got your music into digital form. And so I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that have that sort of dual world existing for themselves, their legacy music that they curated and gathered together from their CD collection or actually physically, not physically, but downloaded in digital form from something like iTunes. And then they're also living in this streaming world. It actually becomes quite inconvenient if you're not sure which is which. I think Apple Music just changed up its interface a bit to make that a little bit more apparent. You know, if you're offline, what's actually downloaded to your device and what's not. So I do think that that has been a big shift. The lack of physical, having the thing on your drive as opposed to taking it out of a stream. And it makes it harder if you don't have it locally somewhere to reuse the music. And I'm sure the music industry is happy about that, but creators suffer for that as well. I just don't see it heading the other direction despite the fact that there certainly is this upswell of creativity going side by side with these developments in the music industry, and maybe where we're going to see the convergence is with newer kind of licensing ideas like the music labels I was mentioning. What do you think, Evan?
Well, there's a part of me that when you say if you don't think it's going to go the other way, mm-hmm. As if to imply we would go back to some former utopian state when everybody was happy about their ownership of music. But when we mm-hmm. stop and think about it, I'm not so sure the old days were any different at a fundamental ownership level. I mean, there's something, mm-hmm. especially in us Americans, you know, we are, we have sprung out of this sort of Lockean sense of personal propriety and ownership of things. That if it's something that we have put our resources in and we buy, then it's our property and we possess it and we should have the right to do with it whatever. So I'm certainly sympathetic to the notion of being a little bit upset and the feeling that I get this music, I license this music is technically what's happening, and I don't own it. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the right, or I am technologically and by copyright law, I am constrained from reusing the work, transferring it to somebody else's device or putting it as a soundtrack to something or what have you, doing something that implicates one of the rights under Section 106 of the Copyright Act. But if you think about mm-hmm. it, go back to just 20 years ago, to 1995, when the thing to do would have been to take your Alanis Morissette CD, right, and say, I want to use, Ironic as a soundtrack for, some kind of VHS tape. I mean, I'm really going far. I'm adding a lot of facts that aren't necessary to the analysis here, but I'm just trying to, whatever.
But they're delightful.
I want to sit and drink a drink a Zima and spray on some CK1 and watch Friends. And okay. So, where was I going with this? You don't own the copyright in that anyway. No. So if you're going to reuse it, you're implicating copyright, and you're going to meet the ire of the copyright owner, the label, right, and the underlying composition. So it's not as if you had this wonderful freedom to do everything you wanted 20 years ago before this new system was set up. It's just that you owned the physical thing, and I guess there's some quasi-illusional satisfaction that we get from having, hey, this is my CD, I own it, I could do whatever I want with it.
Yes and no. I mean, it's a physical and, in terms of service, user agreement barrier to exercising fair use rights. I mean, because fair use rights are out there and exist, and it used to be when you could readily rip your media and you had it there available for use, that you would be the one to decide, okay, is what I'm doing fair use or not, and am I willing to plant my legal flag and go into court on that? It's much harder to do that now. You can do it, but it's harder.
Sure, sure.
Yeah,
I think it's easy to overstate, the instances when a use would actually be fair. Going back to my Alanis Morissette, if I was making a VHS tape of narrating, my junior year in college, and I was using Alanis Morissette as the backdrop, I don't think that would be a fair use. But you just got to search a lot harder than I think what mm-hmm. people will instinctively think to find a use that actually is fair. We all love it. We love fair use because it's liberating, and it's puts the power in the hands of the individual. But the reality is, if you were to look at it empirically, most reuses of works, whether we like this fact or not, are not non-infringing fair uses.
Yeah, we've got a good example of that coming up later in the show, actually. the other point here that's coming up in chat, thank you, Beatmaster, is the first sale doctrine that you alluded to, Mike, that if, your ability to transfer, share, your rights in whatever music you have is strange or non-existent at this time. Whereas, you used to be able to hand somebody something physical or give them your boxes of whatever your collection was. You really can't do that with your digital music collection unless you're actually turning over your computer and they're using it as you. So that's a shift as well. And that's another thing I guess I wish or expected that I would have seen more clarity on in the last 10 years is whether for sale should be ported into this arena. I think it's still an open question. You guys agree?
Well, I'm not sure if I totally agree with that. I mean, Section 109 of the Copyright Act does have this whole notion of first sale, but first sale under the terms of the statute really applied to when the copyright owner puts into the stream of commerce the work itself, that you as the owner of that physical good, you have the right to revend it, to resell it, to give it away. But that's with respect to the physical properties itself. It doesn't give you the right to recopy it or redistribute it. Mm-hmm. And importantly, when it comes to distribution of copyrighted works, you know, the first sale doctrine doesn't apply in the context of a license, which is what we're talking about here. We're talking about streamed music that is provided to the end user. You do purchase it, but you purchase a license to use that particular copy on your device. So I don't think that Section 109 should be stretched outside of the context or should be stretched to include works that are licensed.
Streamed licensed music. Yeah. Evan, do you remember we used to from time to time get the odd case where someone was trying to sell loaded iPods on eBay?
Right.
And go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, the first sale doctrine, I mean, it really does stretch it. If you look at its historical development, you know, coming over from patent law, they call it there the exhaustion doctrine. And I think that's actually a much more useful way of thinking about what's going on here in the legal workings here. Because once you sell something, your rights in it are exhausted. You know, I make a widget and it's patented. I sell that to you. My patent rights in that particular sale are exhausted. I can't then stop you. I can't accuse you of infringement for doing something with that particular widget. Same thing with trademark, a trademark good. If I have a used Ford and I sell it, or if I buy a Ford from the dealership who has the trademark license from Ford to sell cars using the trademark Ford, and I sell that on Craigslist, I'm not infringing Ford's trademark by doing that. Ford's trademark rights have been exhausted in that physical thing. So it all has to do with the thing, the physical thing. And if it's a thing on which the intellectual property protected subject matter is only subject to a license, those rights haven't been exhausted. The owner of the copyright in those works has retained certain rights, namely the ability to stop you from continuing to use those works after the term of the license expires and all that stuff. So it just conceptually doesn't make any sense to apply the first sale doctrine for the most part in terms of the non-physical attributed things that in which the intellectual property is embodied.
Right. I think we'll make That's My Widget our first passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show in case you are a lawyer or other professional and like to listen to or watch the show for professional credit in your field. If you are a lawyer, we've got more information about that on Twit's Wiki. That's at wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there, and there's a whole chart there that tells you the 50 jurisdictions of the United States. If you're a lawyer, how you would go about submitting wherever you live to get MCLE credit for watching or listening to the show. We'll put another phrase in later on in the show so that you can demonstrate in case anybody asks or needs to see something concrete, more than just the name of the show on a list. You can show, oh, yes, I know the phrases, and I watched or listened to episode 363 of This Week in Law. Let us move on for a moment, staying in the music vein here. Mike Masnick had a funny tweet that someone on Twitter threw in front of my nose that had to do with a band who has put together a track that is completely cobbled together out of NSA documents courtesy of Edward Snowden. So we'll play you. It's called Poor Lily. They're kind of a punk rock slash band. We're not going to play you too much of it because it's a little, at least for me, it's a little rough to listen to. But so you can get an idea of the combination of the visual and audio that we're talking about here. It's growing on me, I've got to say. Listening to it the second time through, I think I could come along with the song. Mike Masnick's sort of tongue-in-cheek tweet had to do with who owns the copyright in this? Who gets the songwriter credit for this one? What are the copyright implications when the source material is via Snowden and ultimately the NSA? What do you think, Mike?
Well, I wasn't entirely clear. Maybe you and Evan can help clarify here. What was it exactly that was used by whoever wrote this song, if we want to refer to it as such? Was it that they were reading from some of these NSA? Were they reading from some of these NSA documents, or is it just this mashup that we're talking about?
At least in the video, it's all – maybe it's just the design graphics that we're talking about here because they all seem to be pieces from the leaked documents themselves. I don't know about the lyrics. And again, I think Mike was probably just kind of kidding around when he posted this. But I wanted to throw it in the show because it's weird and wonderful. And if you can go ahead and assume it's the kind of thing, you know, if you're a law professor who needs to be constrained by what actually happened here, you can go ahead and assume that even the lyrics were taken verbatim out of the leaked documents. And in that case, you know, does the songwriter actually get credit for them? I'm guessing that yes, they would, because public documents are in the public domain. I don't know. We could talk about whether NSA documents are public government documents or not. That it's a creative use of them, even if there is some sort of copyright that could be exercised. What do you think, Evan?
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on here. You know, I think you raise an important point there about, you know, if it's the government works, you know, whether and to what extent the federal government created some of that stuff, like they designed the Prism logo, for example. I saw that in there somewhere. But then, but there's a lot of creativity going on at a lot of different layers. You know, you've got what the government did, and then what you have the musical artists doing. I thought that was a catchy song. So it sounds a little bit like Eagles of Death Metal. I know it's not them, but you know, the band that was actually on stage at the Bataclan during the shooting, you know, the ISIS attack in France last year. I guess the more absurd thing would be if you wanted to attribute it to Snowden, that he gets a copyright in as much as it was his selection and arrangement of materials which ones to release. So there you can drop some copyright buzzwords into the analysis that way. So
I think you could make a fun exam question out of all this.
I'm still wondering if what honey trap is. I wonder if that's like a trap for the honey badger or something. I mean, who knows?
I'm sure that has something to do with what went on with the confidential nature of the data. I'm sure somebody in IRC knows. I've heard that term before. I know it has something.
Oh yeah, it's how law enforcement lures hackers in. They leave something open that appears to be, you know, a desirable thing to hack, but it's actually gathering evidence against the hackers. But please, both of you, your homework assignment, if you have not yet been watching this show, is to go watch Mr. Robot. Start from season one and just keep working through. It's a little dark, but it's awesome. And it even has this wonderful self-referential moment where it sort of makes fun of the fact that people actually who are hackers or in the computer industry or whatever. It's like for us as lawyers, right? It's really hard for me to watch many legal dramas because of all the inaccuracies, and you just roll your eyes. And there's a moment in the show, Mr. Robot, where they're talking about how hackers and computer people always, you know, just throw up their hands at most shows that attempt to portray that world with any accuracy. And it sort of acknowledges that, even though I think they're, again, I'm not in that world, but it seems to me to be at least a passably accurate depiction. People seem to use Linux and proper code and things like that. But they do acknowledge that they're just going to be, you know, in the future, or even right now, skewered as somebody who can't accurately capture what's going on.
I hear you. I think it's pretty easy to do that, too. I mean, sort of like, you know, it's easy to sort of butcher legal concepts and stuff. I think we need to be aware of when we're talking about things like that. Last week, I spoke to a group of data scientists, and I was talking about, you know, artificial intelligence and emergent properties and all this stuff. And I actually just paused for a moment and says, look, I'm not an engineer. I'm not a programmer. I know that, you know, you can quickly start talking about things that either are heretical or at best nonsense. So when you get into these things like, oh, I don't know, consciousness and stuff like that, it can easily turn pretty silly. So we've got to sort of be aware of where our limitations are, right?
Yes, exactly. There was one other thing before we move off of music and into some other things. There's an article that I put in the discussion points for today that we haven't touched on yet. It sort of relates to our earlier discussion about the music industry in general. For anyone who wants to read the article in full or anything else we discuss here on the show today, go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. You'll find it under 363 as its tag there, our episode number for today. You can also follow our Flipboard magazine, and I try and put all the links for the show in there too.
Did you finally stop using Friend Feed? Wasn't there? Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah, we used Friend Feed a long time ago. We used to use Delicious to aggregate.
Yes.
Links, but
yes.
Delicious got completely riddled with adware and just didn't enjoy the experience anymore there.
And if you'll recall, at some point in 2008, 2009, we were one of like the 12 people on the face of the earth that utilized Google Wave. That was pretty odd. I thought that lent itself really well.
Google Wave. I'm so glad you pulled that out. I'd completely forgotten about Google Wave. And then I threw myself as enthusiastically into Google Plus, which is still clinging to life. I think it's become one of those things that's far more popular in other countries than it is in the United States. At least it sort of seems that way. But I don't know. Anyway, this article talks about various other things that are that can or are poised to disrupt the music industry right now. And gives examples, including blockchain, VR, a few other things that we've already talked about, record labels and their role. There's a startup called Juke Deck that's mentioned here, a tool that allows people to compose their own music by using a set of algorithms. That kind of thing has wonderful, delightful ways we can play with intellectual property law and think about how it applies. Blockchain, we've talked about on the show as a means to actually identify songs and be able to follow them around and know how that digital file is being used and by whom. So on the entertainment side, certainly something they'll want to be looking into, and we can expect to maybe see more of. And VR too, just making the experience, you know, we just saw a video where the music was one component, but seeing all the graphics was another. And of course, when that becomes completely immersive in a virtual reality kind of experience, I think there's a lot more, not just a deeper creative experience, but probably more rights that copyright law hasn't even thought about yet. You know, how do you copyright a virtual reality experience? Is it exactly the same as how you would experience a film or a video? I don't know. There's a lot more going on there. What do you think, Evan?
More like a pantomime, I imagine, which is one of the enumerated covered works under the Copyright Act. Look it up. It's in there.
Wow. I love it. Mike, any thoughts about these new or disruptive technologies?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I was looking at, I think you mentioned Juke. Is it Juke Deck before the show? I think that's going to be a perfect medium for me to use to create my own version of Honey Trap after the show today. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see a lot more of these disruptive technologies, and you know, everyday musicians putting them to good use, to getting their works out before the public. I think we're going to see a lot more works distributed in this manner, as opposed to the more traditional model. I mean, I think we're already seeing that, but you know, in 10 years we could be sitting here and you know, the whole distribution model of music could be completely changed as a result of all these disruptive technologies. So mm-hmm. be fascinating to see what happens. And yes. And totally agree with Evan, pantomime absolutely is in the Copyright Act.
All right. Yes. So when was the last time either of you saw a copyright decision or complaint, piece of litigation that involved pantomime?
Ooh. Got me there.
I was answering in pantomime.
You were.
Yeah.
But before we started doing the show, yeah. I'm guessing. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, let us move on to talking about celebrities and rights of publicity. This is This Week in Law's third presidential election. We were around for the 2008 election and the 2012 election. And we've seen a lot of, we've had a lot of discussions too about candidates' use of music. That's always a controversial way that intellectual property law intersects with campaigns, and rights holders get up in arms about using works without their permission. The names and likenesses of the candidates can come into play too, as they're being parodied, lampooned. We talked about in a show a while ago now, but still in the course of this campaign. Victor, if you can show us a name and likeness of, there's the name and likeness I wanted to talk about right now, and then we'll move on. Victor, it's over in the right column to talk about other ones. So what I've been seeing this time, and I haven't seen in any of the elections that we've covered yet, is people using the two major party candidates' name and likeness in the service of selling real estate. So this one actually wound up on my front gate. Victor just showed you one that was a billboard. Realtors far and wide seem to have gotten the idea that if people are actually considering moving to Canada because of their throwing up their hands with the current election cycle, that they can provide those services for you to sell your home. I get the feeling it's more tongue-in-cheek than serious, but still, you know, the candidate, this is, and I'm sure, unauthorized use of the candidate's name and likenesses, but it's probably not the most egregious one. And now, Victor, you can show, there was a show where we showed a number of Donald Trump products, and the one that sticks with me and probably sticks in the memory of many of our listeners is the one that we're showing you now, which is a thing that is supposed to be utilized not just as a statue, but for other purposes. If you're just listening to the audio, sorry. I don't know that I'm actually, I maybe already said on the prior show where we covered this, the BP word that I am loath to actually utter now.
Denise, I told my mom to watch this show. Are you seriously? So embarrassing.
It could very well be a paperweight on your desk.
Okay.
In the format of Donald Trump. But once again, an unauthorized use of the candidate's name and likeness. What do you guys think about the realtors' innovation here, Mike?
Oh, I think it's great. Of course, as you pointed out, you know, typically the rule is you can't use somebody else's name, image, or likeness for purposes of advertising a commercial product or service. Uh-huh. And That's exactly what's going on here. In one sense, these images are being used to advertise somebody's real estate services that they want to provide to the public. But in another sense, there's a political statement involved here, a very strong one, obviously, which is, you know, both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are disliked by the electorate to a large extent. People seem to be disgruntled about this election cycle for obvious and very good reasons. And so these realtors are using, the statement, are you moving to Canada, to kind of signify that, you know, are you disgusted with the political process here? Are you ready to get out of the country? And so in that sense, it's clearly got a double entendre here, with a pretty healthy dose of political overtones associated with it. So I think it's great. It's funny. You know, we see there's lots of right of publicity cases out there, certainly involving rock stars and other people that are famous. But when it comes to political figures, you know, at least as far as I know, the law is there's not as many decisions or as many cases involving political figures, because I think to a large extent they don't want to try to challenge their uses that are being made by the public, and probably to a large extent because these uses have political overtones associated with them. And of course, if there's one sacred cow when it comes to First Amendment protection, it's certainly being able to express yourself with respect to the politics of the country. So I'd point out one thing about the images, both that you showed and that Victor showed, the billboard. You might be immune, or you might be successfully able to argue that your use of their images do not violate either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump's right of publicity. But that's a separate issue from the copyright issue. Remember that those images would be protected by copyright. I think the one in particular, true, Denise, that you showed, I've seen those exact same images like on MSNBC. Mm-hmm. So some entity presumably owns the copyright in those images, and that wouldn't necessarily give you the right to reproduce those images from a copyright perspective on a billboard or flyer or what have you. So there's really two different rights at issue. The right of publicity one, I think, is probably more tilted in favor of the publisher, but then you've got the copyright issue, which is a little bit different issue.
Right. Same thing could be true of the not paperweight, mm-hmm, that it came from some other copyrighted image.
Very true.
Evan, any thoughts?
Well, yeah, I agree with, I think ultimately I agree with pretty much everything you said, Mike, because that's a very pragmatic view. But, you know, just for the purposes of discussing and analyzing things, because that's what we do around here, I could suggest that one way that you could slaughter the sacred cow of this political speech, to use your term, calling this protection of political speech a sacred cow being, you know, really important. One way to get at that would be to say this is not a political statement. This is a purely commercial statement. Sure, it's political in its in the indicia of the mode of communication, but there's no political statement about this. This guy doesn't want to do anything but sell real estate or help people selling real estate. So, mm-hmm, I think if you get you look at it from that way, we treat it with a different level of scrutiny. Commercial speech is not entitled to the same constitutional protections as political speech is. And then alongside with that, sort of maybe just by analogy or just by comparison or just, falling into the same region of the universe, there's this idea of special protections for the identities of presidents, and granted, neither of these people are president yet, but special protections for the identity of presidents' name, images, and likenesses being used for commercial purposes as a trademark. There's a special provision in the Lanham Act, which is the federal trademark statute. And being here where I am in the land of Lincoln, where every other commercial enterprise is Lincoln something, it has, you know, the silhouette of Abraham Lincoln on it. You know, we become aware of this. But I think what the essence of what that provision of the Lanham Act says, and I didn't research it preparing for our talk today, this is sort of going by memory here, is that you can't use the name, image, or likeness or whatever of a living president so long as, and I can say this because all presidents have been males, as long as his spouse is still living. So don't quote me on this. Again, I didn't research this, but I think now that Nancy Reagan is dead, perhaps Ronald Reagan's image is more available now for trademark usage. Again, don't go out and launch a business calling it Ronald Reagan carpet cleaning or anything like that until you consult with a lawyer. But, you know, there's something about, right? Am I just making this up, or does this ring any bells with the two of you, that provision in the Lanham Act that protects the you know, living presidents as long as their spouses is still living? Or did I just dream that?
I'm deferring to trademark lawyer Mike on this one.
No, you're exactly right. That provision is in the Lanham Act. I can't recall, though, Evan, if that is a prohibition against the use of name, image, or likeness of a president or a former president, or if it's simply just it precludes registration of a mark containing the name, image, or likeness. I don't recall.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, right. So Evan's absolutely right that this is, you know, this is commercial speech. It clearly is. They are trying to sell this, their services to the end users. But the thing that makes this particularly powerful and has the political overtones associated with it is the use of the images themselves. If you just took that billboard and said, moving to Canada, call me, I want to sell your home, that would be a very mundane, very unmemorable statement, and it really wouldn't have much political overtones associated with it at all. But once you add the images of the two presidential candidates, it completely transforms the meaning of the ad, and it makes it much more political in nature. And the advertiser, the real estate agent, is really trying to connect with other disgruntled people in the electorate. So I think it's really interesting. I've seen several of these. I've never seen anything like this before that I can recall. And the first time I saw one was just a few weeks ago. But since I noticed that first one, I've seen several other ones, including the ones we've been talking about today. So,
right. Well, it's suggesting for me our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, which is worthy of Phil Dunphy. If you are Modern Family fans, I think this is something Phil would definitely do. Let's move on to our final sort of entertainment related story of the day. There's a guy in the UK, his name is Brian Tomo Thompson, and he is not making but selling boxes that allow you to receive unauthorized video streams. The reason this caught my eye and sort of struck me as interesting is he's sort of arguing for some kind of, again, this is in the UK and it is not on the internet in any way. He has a physical store, but what he seems to be wanting is some sort of safe harbor or protection like you would find under the DMCA or Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, where he's not doing the illegal thing. Of course, he's selling products that assist customers in doing an illegal thing. If you could go after the product manufacturer, then they're doing an illegal thing. He's the middleman, though, and he's claiming some sort of middleman immunity in selling these unauthorized illegal streaming boxes. He's taking it to court, and he wants a decision from, I guess, what would be the equivalent of a trial court in the UK as to whether he has any right to sell these boxes or not. Evan, what do you think of all this?
Well, since it's in the UK, as you've emphasized, it's talking about is a little bit like wondering how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But it falls squarely in that region that the Supreme Court addressed in the Sony case in 1984, and then the Grokster case in 2005. For the second time we're talking about Grokster, in our conversation today. And I think the way that we would articulate it is whether he is selling a device here that is capable of a substantial non-infringing use. And then, if that's the case, then I don't know exactly how the analysis should go, if these are the steps we should take. But, one of the questions that we would evaluate at some point along the way is whether the device he's selling is capable of a substantial non-infringing use, or is it substantially capable of a non-infringing use? I can't ever remember which one it is, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Technologically too, it might matter what streams this thing is intercepting. If all it's doing is forming a BitTorrent gateway, then I think that's a different analysis than if it is allowing you to stream things that you could otherwise stream over the top.
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep. So then we get in, that's sort of the Sony Betamax, Universal Studios case from 1984. Then, fast forward to 2005 with Grokster, then there's this new idea of, if you are marketing and promoting the idea, the device, and that's actually the word that Grokster decision used, it's actually more applicable in this situation because we are talking about an actual device, right? We were talking about software in Grokster in 2005. But if you're marketing and promoting it, that with the object of allowing people to infringe, inducing, being contributorial, contributing to their infringement in a way that that's your object, then it runs afoul and you can be secondarily liable here. So I would, if people who are watching the video see on the screen, I mean, there are a lot of brands there. There are a lot of proprietary content providers listed on the screen, and one should only assume that all the content coming from those things is copyrighted by someone. So it makes it a little bit difficult if it's being promoted this way to say that it's not being with the object of promoting infringement. So it doesn't look great, at least using the vocabulary words that we have from our case law over here and doctrines in the U.S.
Right. These are Kodi boxes. I was unfamiliar with Kodi until we started looking at this. And Plutonium Source in IRC is saying Kodi is an open source platform that allows for third-party scripts. People put these boxes together, load it up with these third-party scripts, and sell them. So it seems like, again, Kodi has substantial non-infringing uses, but then it depends what you do with them, whether they're going to infringe or not. Mike, any thoughts?
No, nothing further. I think you guys really covered it well.
Okay, then let us move on, talk about a couple of things in the arena of copyright.
Oh, we weren't talking about copyright?
We were. Mm-hmm. But now we're not talking about entertainment, really.
I still can't get over how that label on that VCR tape looks like Tennessee, and that is a special signal that Franklin sent us. If you watch that, I always think of Franklin, especially on that one. So,
yes, I do too. And I want to, and now is just as good a time as any, as we're, sitting here having sort of a retrospective experience on the show today. And as I said, we're kind of celebrating the show's 10th anniversary throughout the month. But I want to take a moment and just thank our wonderful, wonderful interns for the show. And it's probably a good time to do it with Emery not here with us now, so he doesn't get all embarrassed. But of course, our current intern is Emery Roan, also co-host on the show. He's just wonderful and has done such a fantastic job. And it's so great to see a young person with so much passion and knowledge and insight who's going to, I know, do great things in his life. And we're just thrilled to have a bit of his time as he sojourns with us here on This Week in Law. You mentioned Franklin Graves, who's gone on and is in private practice in Tennessee. I was recently on the show. I was sad to miss him. I was out that day. Sandoe was my intern here for a couple of years, and also Rebecca Klosner. And they've done just a fantastic job for us. And so excited to be able to work with them and hopefully give them some experience in doing this kind of thing and thinking about these kinds of issues. So we really, really appreciate all of their volunteer work. Let us get into talking about an issue where fair use was not found. And it involves one of our favorite folks to talk about, Newegg and Lee Cheng, its general counsel. Apparently what happened here, I'm not going to go too deep into the weeds of the facts of this case, but Newegg was involved in an appeal. There was another party that was a co-appellee with them. They were going to file an appellate brief. And Newegg's lawyer came up with a briefing on the issues that were going to be involved in the case, and they shared them with this other party simply for informational strategic purposes. What the other party did was basically wholesale copy the brief and then file it. And Newegg wound up suing them for copyright infringement. And then there was some adjustment where, oh, we're going to withdraw that first brief and file a shorter one, which still used much of what had been a problem before. The court looked at this and found that the argument that was made was fair use, that their use of these, and there were verbatim arguments here. It seems like sort of an awkward application of the fair use doctrine when what you're really involved in is plagiarism. And the court applied the fair use factors and found, no, this isn't what fair use is supposed to apply to, and Newegg won. So, Evan, since we were talking about fair use before, do you have any anything further to add to this? Did you think the court got it right?
I don't have anything to add on the fair use aspect of it. It probably was a good decision on the court to not find this a fair use. But I think the more interesting issues on this are one. And I know Lee Cheng is a friend of the show, so I'm not going to try to say anything too bad about Newegg and all this stuff. But I would, if he were here, I would ask him. It's like, you know, could you address sort of the obvious question, or I think it's an obvious question. Isn't it a bit ironic that you are a plaintiff in an intellectual property lawsuit? You know, everybody knows Newegg is being, oh, we hate patents, we hate patent trolls. You know, they're not as bad as Stefan Kinsella of saying, you know, all intellectual property law ought to be abolished and all that stuff. But you know what I'm saying? Isn't there a little bit of an irony here? And I would ask Lee about that if you were sitting here, just the way I asked it right then.
Right.
But the other interesting issue I think here is the question about copyright and what is good copyright management for attorney work product? The way this comes up in my practice is I write a lot of terms of service and privacy policies for online companies, whether they're providing some kind of hosted solution or an app or just, you know, plain website or what have you. And I find it delightful when I will go from time to time and I will pick out a real arbitrary string of text that only I come up with, because there are certain turns of phrase that I know that only I have used, especially in situ, you know, in those terms of service. So I'll do a Google search for that, and I'll find, you know, 100 results where other companies have just copied and pasted the terms of service that I wrote for my client. And when the first time I saw that happen, I thought about picking up the phone and calling my client to say, do you want to sue this company for copyright infringement? And then before I actually picked up the phone and made that call, I recognized, wait, my client doesn't own the copyright in those terms of service. I do, or more accurately, probably my employer does, because I'm, you know, created those as a work made for hire. So it'd be interesting to see if it has come out yet, or how this came out in discovery, or whether or not all this stuff is of by what mechanism did the attorney, I'm assuming it was outside counsel for Newegg, who wrote this brief that is alleged to have been infringed by this New Jersey lawyer. By what mechanism did that attorney assign the rights in the copyright to that brief to Newegg so that Newegg can be the plaintiff. And, you know, because that would be one of those interesting issues. And then just going back to the legal practice thing for any of the lawyers listening, you know, I would be very reluctant to assign the copyright in my work product to my clients because this may come as a huge surprise to people out there. And I may lose a lot of respect for this. But for those of you out there who are non-lawyers who think that your lawyer, every time he or she provides you with a work product, has sat down and created that document from scratch, start to finish, I need to disabuse you of that illusion because lawyers do use forms and you know, take stock language that they have already. And if I were to assign my copyright or my law firm's copyright to the client, then I could potentially be precluded from using that same text in work that I do for other clients. So there's a lot of different things to consider and different moving parts here from a number of different angles of interest, I think. So I'm glad you brought this one up.
Right. The other thing that I think is a good starting point for looking at this is are legal briefs copyrightable? This isn't the first case that we've talked about or the first case that I've seen where there was plagiarism of a legal brief. And there is law out there that says that although they are they're, you know, public documents, they're filed publicly, et cetera, they're part of a legal process. They, and this case in particular, cited a New York decision that called them copyrightable functional presentations of fact and law. So it's a weird little niche there that I think legal briefs fall into. The other thing that was interesting here is that the judge, and I guess it's just a good lesson, and this is something that, you know, we've tried to get across to folks who've been listening to the show from the beginning, that fair use is really a crapshoot and you don't know how a judge is going to decide to apply it. The court here actually found a couple of the fair use factors weighed in favor of the person who had copyrighted the brief, but that didn't matter. The court found other factors that didn't, and I think the court probably had a very clear idea of how it wanted the case to come out, because it could put a colorable fair use analysis or analysis declining to apply the fair use doctrine on this. That's exactly what it did. Mike, any other thoughts?
I agree with Evan. I'd be really curious to know what the backstory is here. You would think this would be one of those disputes that would probably never be filed and that the parties would settle or find a way to settle it. But setting that issue aside, I mean, it seems to me the court's got it right here that, you know, taking a brief, if it's a wholesale copying of it or taking substantial portions of it and literally passing it off as the work product that you're submitting on behalf of a client, I think that that is problematic from a copyright standpoint and also, frankly, from a plagiarism standpoint as well. You know, this dispute, it reminded me of one that was wending its way through various federal courts a few years ago. There were a number of third-party publishers that sued some patent attorneys a few years ago, claiming that as part of the patent application process, when those patent attorneys would include article references to show prior art or for various and sundry reasons, they submitted articles to the patent office, those publishers were claiming that that was copyright infringement. And ultimately, one, if not two, court decisions issued saying, actually, that's a fair use. So it may seem a little bit murky as to what the status is of copyright protection when it comes to legal submissions. But at least for my money, this one seemed to make sense.
Okay, and then something else that I thought would have evolved more than it has over the last 10 years is the exemption process that's involved in the DMCA. If you want to have an exemption from the anti-circumvention provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, every 3 years you have to go back to the Copyright Office and say, we got an exemption for this before, and all the same reasons apply, and here they are again, and the Copyright Office considers each exemption anew and whether it should be granted or not to allow certain classes of people to break copy protections in order to manipulate various technologies. But one thing that is changing is the Copyright Office is now, finally, this year, it has asked for comments about whether the DMCA should be reformed in this regard and may, in fact, look at making at least some of the exemptions more permanent than every 3 years. There are written comments that it has requested that must be received by no later than 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on October 27th. And then there's a time for reply comments by 11:59 p.m. on November 16th. So just wondering what you guys think of this. It could be less of a headache for the people who go through the exemption process every time. Do you think it's a good or a bad thing, Mike?
Do I think that the exemption process is a good thing or a bad thing?
That the Copyright Office is actually, it apparently may be inclined to consider exemptions that are maybe permanent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, to the extent that the Copyright Office is considering and comes up with permanent exemptions, if it's statutorily authorized to do so, I think that's probably a good thing. You know, the DMCA, as we've talked about before on the show, you know, there's some obvious issues with it from some perspectives, but you know, it's also allowed, I think, the internet to develop into this very fulsome medium that we see today. So, you know, like a lot of things we talk about, I think there's arguments on both sides of the equation, but, you know, we'll leave it to the Copyright Office to see, or actually, I guess it's ultimately the Librarian of Congress that can make recommendations pursuant to the statute. So we'll kind of see what happens here.
Yep. Evan, what do you think?
Well, I'm not aware of any, you know, real life disputes that would be driving this. I mean, certainly there are hobbyists who want the freedom to tinker. And there are the Derek Khanas of the world who get very, very exercised about being able to, you know, do what you want with your cell phone. And I'm not being diminutive of that. I'm just trying to point out that these aren't top shelf, high priority, red hot emergency public policy issues. They're important, but they're not, you know, red hot emergency, got to be resolved now, or our way of life and our civilization will crumble into the oblivion of history. So what I think we need to see is a situation that is going to give a clear focus, and whether this is some dispute wins its way through the court or there's a well-articulated policy argument made in whatever form, whether it be by the EFF petitioning the Librarian of Congress or through think tanks issuing white papers or what have you, to show that the anti-circumvention provisions in, you know, Section 1201, 1202, that they present serious constitutional problems, because where this comes out particularly is in fair use. And depending on how you evaluate it, or what commentator you ask, or how the whole issue is articulated, to the extent that one is prohibited from making a fair use of something because of some government restriction, there is a First Amendment free speech problem there, because copyright is no longer in the way. Theoretically, copyright is a constitutionally acceptable restraint on speech, because copyright is actually part of the Constitution. So there's no First Amendment problem. It doesn't even make sense to say that my First Amendment rights are being violated if I can't speak in the form of willful infringement. That argument isn't even valid, let alone true. So if copyright is taken out of the way, namely, I would be able to make a fair use here, there's no other obstacle in the process that should stand in my way of being able to speak freely. Say I wanted to rip this is the textbook example. I want to rip this DVD to make a non-infringing fair use of it. I ought not to be restrained by some what you would characterize as, you know, out of the blue restriction in Section 1201, and therefore that portion of as applied should be held unconstitutional. So to the extent that that were a real problem and there were these things happening all the time and courts were deciding this issue all the time, I could see Congress taking some interest in amending the anti-circumvention provisions. And you know, I'm not saying that they shouldn't, but I don't know that it's real likely that they will, even though it might be an important constitutional question.
Right. It's an important enough constitutional question that the EFF has actually brought a suit and is pursuing a suit on those issues.
Of course they are. Of course.
Yes.
What constitutional issue is not important enough to them? But, you know, they do good work. I sound like I'm being critical on this, but, you know, we got to keep it in perspective of the larger thing. This is exactly what I tell every time we talk to Derek Khanna. It's like, I know, dude, it's important, but come on, let's not get an ulcer over it, you know?
Well, I don't know. I have Dr. Morbius in IRC, if I'm reading his handle correctly, is pointing out that the PC industry entirely exists because people were able to reverse engineer and come up with hardware that resulted from that process. There was a whole TV series on this. It was on a while ago. I get what you're saying about how maybe the importance of doing that doesn't leap immediately to mind necessarily, especially in the context of the election cycle that we're in right now. But historically, things like reverse engineering have a lot to do with how we're able to do everything we do today. And I would love to see law that reflected that there are certain reasons why circumventing copy protection should absolutely be encouraged as opposed to prohibited. And maybe they're not high on people's radar screens, but they can have important ramifications, I guess, is the point.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. So let's see, where are we going next? Let's, since we're talking about things like legislation and reforming the DMCA already, let's talk some more about legislation and policy.
Oh, yeah.
That's your favorite bumper, I know. Where shall we start? We could start with Bitcoin, Evan, because we've had a long time back and forth, you and I, on the show over whether Bitcoin was a thing that we should all be paying attention to and would even survive, you know, much more than its first year of existence. There's an interesting, and the reason I have it under legislation and policy is that there are various regulators have sort of thrown up their hands when it comes to Bitcoin and are not quite sure how to regulate or deal with it and whether it will bring down, you know, bring our financial markets crashing down around us. I spotted an article on that is headlined, "Is Bitcoin Doomed?" And I thought immediately of you, Evan. But this one is not about, you know, whether it will achieve economic viability or whether it has. This is that it will be superannuated once we have quantum computing, which would prevent Bitcoin from functioning the way that it is designed to function. The encryption that allows it to function and the blockchain in general wouldn't survive the computational power that could undo all the encryption. So just wanted to toss that out, see how you're feeling about Bitcoin and the Bitcoin marketplace these days, Evan.
Oh, unfortunately, I interjected my ego into this too much when in 2011 I said, a year from now, we won't be even talking about Bitcoin. So I'm like really, really, really wanting it to go away only because of, you know, for selfish reasons so that I'll be vindicated. So I have nothing against Bitcoin. Okay, fine. The other thing is I don't feel so bad having said that because I think it was in 2006, 2007, Eric Goldman, the esteemed, inimitable Eric Goldman, the never not awesome Eric Goldman, wrote a blog post, I think, or I don't think he was more formal. I don't think he wrote a law review article about it, but he went into some detail about how he thought 5 years from then, this must have been, 10 years ago, Wikipedia would exist no more. So I don't feel so bad saying, in 2011 that Bitcoin wasn't going to exist in a year's time if Eric Goldman said that Wikipedia wasn't going to exist anymore in 5 years, and that those 5 years came and went. So I don't feel so bad. But okay. But with this Bitcoin thing, what it looks like here is that, as I understand it, right, is that there's this concern with quantum computing that our ability to compute numbers and decrypt things is going to increase so much that the technological underpinnings of the blockchain technology are going to implode, right? Am I getting that right here? So it's not a legal or a regulatory thing. It's a technological thing, which leads me to think, well, if there's a technological problem, there will be a technological solution. It seems as easy as that when it comes to just the matter of it being a one of sophistication and being able to crunch bigger numbers, right? Or is this really going to be the end of it? Is quantum computing, doesn't that seem a little bit short-sighted to think that there won't be just a more appropriate solution put in place to solve this problem?
I don't know. That's above my pay grade, I'm afraid. If they can build encryption that can withstand quantum computing, certainly probably people are working on it. So more power to them. The other thing I thought it would be fun to toss into this discussion is there is an app. This is how far Bitcoin has sort of permeated the zeitgeist. There's an iOS app. I don't know if it's available for Android as well, but I've seen it in the iOS store, called HackX. That is, it's a virtual hacking game. And you attack other people's systems and you can DDoS them and various other things. But part of the goal of the game is to steal other people's Bitcoin and amass Bitcoin, which I think actually is counterintuitive to how Bitcoin works. You're not supposed to be able to steal Bitcoin, right? That's why blockchain is, we talked about it being important to the music industry as a way of possibly identifying files and being able to track exactly where they've gone. So I don't know if the theft analogy holds up very well, but I thought you'd be interested to see, Evan, that how much money people are spending. I find this so funny. Real money that people are spending, the top in-app purchases on this game are for Bitcoins, virtual Bitcoins, not real Bitcoins that would be worth real money.
Yeah. Right. So
I just thought that was pretty funny.
Two layers of abstraction there. Yeah,
yes.
That's great.
Yes. Mike, any thoughts?
No, this is a bit outside of my wheelhouse, but I'm enjoying listening in.
All right. Let's talk about space law. That's outside all of our wheelhouses, so why should we not talk about it? Great article from Gizmodo, querying whether, here's the title, is Elon Musk's crazy Mars plan even legal? And going into the fact that things are really wide open, as our space law panel here on the show underscored as well, as far as what can and can't be done with all of the private commercial endeavors that are trying to get us into space one way or another. Quote from the article is, all we really know is at this point is that under the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, the United States is responsible for any and all activity a U.S. company engages in on another celestial body. So you can bet that the FAA and other federal authorities are going to be keeping a close eye on what Musk and SpaceX do and what their plans are as far as getting into space and going there repeatedly. If you look into what the plans for Mars are. I think it's just a fascinating and wide open policy situation that we find ourselves in, and wondered if you guys had any thoughts. Evan, can we shut down Elon Musk, or should we?
Well, I see that I'm going to expand my, practice areas. I'm going to become a scholar on the 1967, space treaty, whatever that was. I had no idea that exists. Call me uninformed, but it's it raises some interesting questions, because if we think about the idea of traveling to other planets, it's going to take a lot of resources to do that, right? A lot of resources for one enterprise to do that. You know, it takes a lot of resources for one government to do that. So there's no reason to think that in combination with amassing the resources to actually do that, there will be the appropriate amount of lobbying to take place to make sure that the questions have been answered in a way that's clear, and you know, both in terms of how we would manage that under domestic law, and then also in accordance with international treaties and our obligations to other countries and what have you like that. I mean, clearly, regulators are going to want to regulate the heck out of this, probably want to tax the heck out of it somehow. I don't want to be too cynical about things on those lines. I guess the alternative is for an enterprise that's going to take off and go colonize Mars, you could just say, I don't care what the treaties say. I don't care what the law of the earth is, what the law of the country is, what the regulations say. I'm taking off in a rocket. I don't ever plan on coming back. So go ahead and chase me if you think you can serve me with process on Mars. You know, so go right ahead. You know, be my guest. I'm, you know, so I have a feeling it'll probably be more. We'll figure this stuff out as we're going along, right?
Right. So interestingly, I think it was last month. Yes, there's Moon Express, which was a Google Lunar XPRIZE contender, received a favorable payload determination from the FAA for its request to stick a lander on the moon. The FAA decided that they could go ahead and do it, that there wasn't a threat of harm or any threat to national security by them doing that. But as this article points out, this is going to be taken on a case-by-case basis. It's not setting a precedent. It's just, you know, one thing that somebody asked to do that the FAA signed off on and said okay. So I think going forward, we're going to see some interesting queries posed and answers given. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, it seems like this has got to be something that's many years in the making. But you know, Elon Musk is so he's such an interesting guy. I mean, I could see that if he's not getting satisfaction with the FAA and the regulators, that he's going to find some other country that's not bound by this treaty and see if he can make his dream to colonize Mars happen. I mean, you could see something like that happening. So this is going to be. Yeah. This is going to be really great to see. And, you know, I'm not sure that we might even need to see an amendment to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to talk about how you go about serving parties in space. So, I mean, who knows?
It does.
Now that Twitter seems to be an appropriate means of serving process, I think, you know, as long as there's connectivity, we're all okay.
That's true. No, you know, this. It also struck me that these realtors, you know, could have a new tagline: "Moving to Mars."
You know, I can tell you're. And if Musk is looking for more volunteers, I think people, you know, continue to be anxious to go to Mars, much to my surprise, on these experimental missions, and that there's no shortage of people lining up to go be among the first to explore. But if he runs up against sort of a wall and he needs more people to go, he might go to the drone racers, who also have an issue with the FAA, and maybe they can go up and race on Mars all they want and not have to worry about whether they're too young or whether they've registered their device or what happened. So you could get all the conscientious FAA objectors to take off in Evan's rocket and go wait to get served. All right, yes. I think that will do it for our discussion of space law. Let's get to my favorite bumper that we seldom get to use, other.
Ooh, never seen this one before.
It just cracks me up for some reason. Yep.
Yeah, that does surreal, it.
The surreal nature of the other bumper. Okay, so one of the things that we've talked about a lot on This Week in Law over the years during your tenure, Evan, are taco suits. I think that was a term coined for us by Nilay Patel when he was on the show, referring to class action lawsuits The taco suit in particular he was referring to was a suit against Taco Bell of over whether or not the substance in their beef tacos was actually something one could scientifically call beef. Class action suits, we have a few of them going on, or the aftermath of a few of them we could talk about today. I'll go ahead and just show you my other prop for the day is my tiny little check that I received as part of it's for 44 cents from AT&T that was the result of a class action settlement. So I really don't know if any of these settlement checks were over a dollar. I did a little research. This had to do with why was this lawsuit even filed? It had to do with taxes and fees, I think, that were not being properly calculated for AT&T customers, and they got sued over this. So they reached a settlement where they're sending checks that literally cost more to send than they do, you know, to fatten the bank accounts of the people who are receiving them. There is, at least up in Northern California, a drive for everyone who received these things to donate them, to be used for a good cause. Other people are just perplexed. Like, they don't remember participating in the settlement or opting into the settlement. In one of these articles, it says the lowest payout was a penny, and the highest one guy got was $20 out of this. I don't know, you know, how he had been ripped off so much more than the other class members. But I guess it just sort of goes along with our other bumper as sort of a surreal result of class action litigation is you may get unexpected checks for 44 cents. Guys, any thoughts?
Might have been with that mysterious device or that mysterious cable in the – wasn't that an AT&T office in San Francisco that the EFF filed suit over? So they can't tell us – can't tell you what it is. But, you know,
no, I think – yeah, that's not what they're settling here. Class actions and or taco suits in the news this week – involved, of course, the exploding Samsung Note 7s. The lawsuits are starting to roll in on those. Although, as I started to dig into this a little, there are certain people that have filed directly against Samsung. There's a Seattle law firm, Mike, I wonder if you're familiar with them, who says it will likely be the class action, the class counsel for the class action that is coming over the Samsung Note 7. And then it appears that some iPhones are exploding too. At least a woman in Fresno recently had her iPhone explode and catch fire, and she was given a replacement, but not an upgrade, much to her dismay. So classic, I guess, product liability suits. iPhone came out in our second year of operation here at This Week in Law, came out in 2007. I guess looking back over 10 years of smartphone development, I did not expect them to all start blowing up in 2016. I thought we would have probably been past that phase, but maybe it has to do with the fact that they're trying to milk as much battery life and space out of these tiny components as possible. So anything to add, guys? Anything you want to think about exploding phones, Evan?
Well, absolutely no surprise that there was going to be litigation over it. I mean, and you know, some of these sound pretty bad. I'd be pretty upset if my phone was in my front pants pocket. And the allegations in that one case is that it started moving. You know, what about that?
Oh, God, no, I didn't know there was like a Caterpillar feature that came into play here.
Yeah, so I'd be a little bit freaked out. And you know, if the allegations are true, the guy suffered second and third degree burns. And so, yeah, I mean, it clearly, it's a thing. Clearly, Samsung has had a terrible last 6 weeks, however long this has been, both in terms of this stuff happening and not favorable decisions from the courts. And so, you know, no decision whatsoever. And it's easy to sort of poke fun at it. But, you know, for the people who really are injured here. This is no laughing matter. So we got to be polite, right? So
no, absolutely. Have you guys flown during this period while the Samsung phones have been? It's so funny to hear the flight attendants announce that if you have a Samsung Note 7, don't turn that puppy on while we're flying. Don't charge it. I was wondering whether Apple and Samsung might countersue each other over the phone explosion patents, and we could have a whole other chain of long-running Apple versus Samsung, Samsung versus Apple litigation. Mike, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable to see an international powerhouse brand like Samsung, where it's had so much bad publicity, unfortunately, just over the course of, what's it been, a month, month and a half, couple of months maybe. And then I was surprised to hear, I hadn't heard anything about iPhones catching a blaze, but you mentioned that one report, Denise, and then we also read another report about a student that apparently had his iPhone in his back pocket, maybe during class, and it also caught fire. So I don't know. Maybe this is a recent phenomenon, as you're mentioning, Denise, about the technology trying to suck as much life out of the batteries, and maybe that with the thinner casing or something. It's who knows exactly what's going on. I guess we'll somebody's going to get to the bottom of this at some point. But totally agree with Evan as well. Not surprised at all that we're seeing litigation, and no doubt we'll see more litigation in the days and weeks to come over this.
All right. I think we're going to move on to our show concluding material in a moment here. But first, we're going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is Braintree, code for easy mobile payments. Maybe you're working on the next Uber, Airbnb, or GitHub. Then why not use the same simple payment solution that helped them become what they are today? Braintree makes mobile payments so fast, easy, and seamless, it's almost magical. Add it to your app with just a few lines of code, and you're instantly ready to accept Apple Pay, Android Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even Bitcoin, Evan. And if some other way to pay comes along, Braintree will also support that. Braintree's fast payouts and continuous support mean you'll always be ready, whether you're earning your first dollar or your billionth. See fewer abandoned carts and more sales with Braintree's best-in-class mobile checkout experience. Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types your customers might want, single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. To check it out for yourself, visit BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. And before we do move on to our animal selfie of the week and the other closing items we have for you all today, Victor in the studio was wondering, Mike, and I thought this was a good question, whether you remember the Usain Bolt case we were talking about, the silhouette trademark ramifications there. I guess we're more in the realm of trademark there than copyright, but he wondered if any of that might play into a copyright infringement for pantomime.
that's an interesting question. I kind of think not, but I'll have to ruminate over that this weekend.
All right.
I should mention while we're talking about interesting legal issues, Evan had brought up the bit about presidents and the Lanham Act and how the use of a president's image is allowed or not allowed. And what the rule is under the Lanham Act, you're not entitled to get a registration involving a deceased president without the deceased president's spouse's approval. So
good. So Ronald Reagan, fair game now.
Yes, I believe that's probably registration. For registration, of course, you still have state right of publicity laws that apply even after somebody is deceased. And in California, I can't remember what it is, if it's 50 years after a celebrity is deceased that you could start using his or her image, something like that. So still not safe under state law.
Yeah, right. I'm going to go with James K. Polk then or something. I think the 11th president is probably not going to. His heirs aren't gonna worry about anything. Right. Anyway, go on.
All right. Let us know when they get in touch, Evan. Yep. Let's look at our animal selfies of the week. Evan, these are new from your tenure on the show in honor of Naruto the macaque and rights in photos taken by animals specifically is how we started doing this. But we're pretty much willing to feature the broader definition of selfies with animals and just pictures of animals that are called selfies, like we were talking about ballot selfies last week, which are really just pictures of your ballot. So the term selfie seems to be going through a linguistic renaissance itself. But here are animal selfie of the week. We are going to show you a couple of things this week. First, the selfie stick for dogs. It's an attachment for your phone. It's not really for your dog to take selfies him or herself, but it attaches a tennis ball to the top of your phone. It's called Pooch Selfies. And what Pooch Selfies theory is here is you're going to get better pictures of you and your dog or other animal. But I think this, you know, probably is more inclined to appeal to a dog who wants to catch this tennis ball than anything else, that the dog is going to perk up and pay attention when you hold the phone in front of it and there's a tennis ball on top. So if you're interested in getting the very, very best pictures of yourself and your dog using your phone, you can check out the selfie stick for dogs and let us know the results. Yes, Evan?
My question, I guess, would be to Mike. Mike, what would it take to get your attention instead of a tennis ball for to get you to look at the phone? What would they have to put there?
That's another thing I'll have to think about over the weekend.
A non paperweight of Donald Trump would probably catch my attention on the top of a phone. From chat, I think Virgil sent this my way in chat during the show just as we were speaking. And again, this is in no way, shape, or form technically a selfie, but it's the cutest little picture of a caterpillar, the Trumpapillar, fluffy caterpillar that looks just like Donald Trump's hair. So if you can figure out a way to get the Trumpapillar to take a picture of itself, that would be the best way for us to really get our teeth into a legal discussion about it. Other than that, we can really just admire the fact that this creature exists and someone has found it and photographed it for us. It's the flannel moth caterpillar. It has fluffy orange tufts that may resemble something we're seeing a lot on TV these days. Let us go on to our tips and resources of the week. We have one tip for you. Our tip has to do with Facebook Marketplace, which Facebook is attempting to get off the ground. It's had a little trouble though. So our tip is if you think that you're able to make your gun, drug, and hedgehog purchases using Facebook Marketplace, I'm sorry, you'll have to think again. Unfortunately, the ads for such products on the marketplace that you might have seen in the last week or so have been removed and were the function of a technological glitch that had to do with their review process, unsurprisingly enough. So I think as we record here today, all I was able to find online was the Facebook page for its new marketplace, not the marketplace itself. I think they are still tinkering with their competitor to eBay and Amazon and other venues, Craigslist, I guess, that allow people to sell things directly to one another. Stay tuned, but no baby hedgehogs are going to be for sale for you there. Our resources of the week are a triple play for journalists who might be listening. If you are a journalist or a citizen journalist or someone who's just interested in these issues, I hope that you will appreciate. There's a wonderful Shield Law primer from the Columbia Journalism Review. The basics every reporter should know about Shield Laws and confidential sources. So if that's you. You should definitely take a look at this. It goes in into why the reporter's privilege exists, where it comes from, who's privileged, what's privileged, when the privilege doesn't apply, what search warrants mean, and protecting sources. So something that might be valuable to some of our listeners, I hope. Also, if you're a journalist or know people who are, you will want to check out Secure Drop, which is comes to you from our friends at the Freedom of the Press Foundation, Trevor Tim and others responsible for this tool. And what it is a tool for, you know, if you find yourself in a whistleblower kind of situation, or you want to report on somebody's trying to reach out to you as a reporter and give you information, try and communicate with you securely, Secure Drop will fit that bill for you. It's a whistleblower submission system that media organizations can use to securely accept documents from and communicate with anonymous sources. So in keeping with that vein, too, you may or may not have seen that Edward Snowden's Ben Wisner — I haven't watched this episode of Triangulation yet. I'm hoping to do that this weekend. I hope I'm saying it right. Ben Wisner or Ben Wisner, but I'm going with Wisner, was on Triangulation this week with Leo Laporte. So like me, I encourage you to check out Ben Wisner on Triangulation and learn more about what it's like to be counsel for Ed Snowden. And with that, I think that's everything we got for you here today. Evan, it's been so great to chat with you again. I'm so glad that you could take the time to come back on the show.
It sure has been great. Thanks for having me back. Really enjoyed the conversation. Mike, enjoyed meeting you and talking with you, and glad we got to cover a broad range of topics. It's always fun to get in and see what's new and reflect on the past and just sort of get into it. So really, really am grateful for the opportunity. Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure. Please tell us what's going on with your practice, with your teaching, anything else that you want people to know before we go ahead and sign off today?
Practice is good, you know, technology, intellectual property, a lot of working with a lot of technology companies, big and small, a lot of startups, early stage companies, you know, working with developers, you know, doing a lot of branding, social media, trademark stuff as well. Still a panelist with the World Intellectual Property Organization deciding domain name disputes as well. On the faculty at John Marshall Law School here in Chicago, teaching a course on intellectual property in the global digital environment. Doesn't that sound great? And also still on the faculty at Kent Law School. I teach a class over there every other couple semesters on negotiations. So that's a lot of fun as well.
That's fantastic. And internetcases.com is still alive and well. This is Evan's blog where he posts really interesting and usually pretty deep dives on new cases that have come out, and his unique perspective and analysis as to how they move things forward or around on the chessboard that is the world of IP law. How old is Internet Cases now? It's been around for a long, long time too.
Yeah, since January of 2005. So back in those days I was talking about earlier, you know, when about the time that we started experiencing the world through broadband and really, you know, RSS was starting to be a thing and podcasting. Mm-hmm. So that's when I started blogging, and it's the world, or my world, has never been the same since. So thanks for the plug.
Sure. Absolutely. My pleasure. It's such a thrill to chat with you again. Mike Keyes, great chatting with you too. It's been a really fun show. Mike, of course, is a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle and a co-author of their great blog, The TMCA.
Denise, as always, it's been a real pleasure. That was a great show. And Evan, thanks so much for coming on today and sharing your insight and perspective. Great to have you. And your blog's terrific. I certainly encourage and commend it to all of our listeners.
Well, thanks, Mike. And feelings mutual. Appreciate it.
All right. We're so glad that you've been able to join us today. I thanked our interns a little earlier in the show. There's some other people in addition to Evan who've been on the show a lot over the last 10 years that I just wanted to mention. Colette Vogel being one. She was on just recently again. Sarah Pearson, who came and co-hosted with me for a bit. Marty Schwimmer, who comes on whenever I ask him and is happy to do so. So many other people who have been repeat.
Ernie Svensson,
the attorney, very, very early legal blogger, may have been the proto legal blogger. I don't know. We can split hairs about that. But yes, Ernie was great. Hank Berry was our very favorite, our very first guest on TWIL back when we debuted in 2006. Hank Berry, former CEO of Napster, venture capitalist, now an attorney in private practice, and amazing, amazing person. We've just been so blessed over the years to have all these people give us so generously their time and thoughts and insights and humor. And I'm just thrilled that we still get to do it every week, week in, week out at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's when we record the show. So please join us live if you can. If you can't, don't worry about it. Head on over to twit.tv/twill and you'll find 10 years of archived shows waiting for you to delve into and explore. Each and every one of them has been so special to me and so fun to do. I'm thrilled that I don't know if we have people who've listened to the shows going all the way back to 2006. If so, thank you so much. That's amazing. We're glad that you've been here with us all that time. If you've just now tuned in, we hope that you like what you have listened to and that you'll join us again too soon. We hope you'll get in touch with us between the shows. You can find us on Twitter. I'm Dee Howell. Mike is J. Michael Keyes there. Please reach out to us and let us know what's caught your eye, your attention, people you think we should invite on, things you'd like to see us delve into more deeply, comments, reactions you have to things we've discussed. We'd love, love, love to hear from you. You can also email us. Mike is mike@twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. You can find us on Facebook and on Google+ as well. If you have more than you want to say in a tweet and want to do it in public. So however you go ahead and get in touch with us, we love hearing from you. Even if, you know, tell me a joke. I get listeners who send me jokes from time to time. They send me Netflix recommendations. They send me just things they think I might find interesting. And it's really wonderful. It adds significant value to my life. So thank you all for all that you give us here at This Week in Law. And we will see you next week. Until then, take care.
Right on.
Right on.